Coming up, I'm going to break down week 15 gambling in the NFL with Million Dollar Picks. And what else do we have? I had some other guest. Oh, Barack Obama. It's the Bill Simmons Podcast presented by FanDuel. Take a shot at betting the NBA with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub, filtered by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting on the Explore page and the Pulse and bet live same-game parlays for every NBA game. Download the app today. Bet with FanDuel, official partner of the NBA. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available and listen to the end of the episode for additional details. You must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. This episode is brought to you by Monopoly Go. It's halftime and the scoreboard's not looking good. You're not sure you can pull out a win? That's when you say to yourself, it's time to get back in the game. Pull off some bank heists and take as much of my friend's money as I possibly can. That's right. The hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to be the biggest tycoon ever. I might do this with my high school friends. We used to play Monopoly all the time. It's the Monopoly you love, but on your phone anytime with tons of new twists, including leaderboards to compare your progress. There's so much to do. Play on countless dynamic Monopoly boards. Make your friends bankrupt by smashing their landmarks with a wrecking ball. Charge other players rent for your iconic properties. Maybe you'll even play against me. I'm great at Monopoly. You could even work with your friends to crack open community chests and in tournaments to get extra rewards. Get back out there. Put on your game face. Download Monopoly Go. Now free on the App Store or Google Play. We're also brought to you by the Ringer Podcast Network, where you can find my Book of Basketball, the 6 podcasts we put up for season 3 went up this week. Chris Weber, Joe House, and I tackled it. Joe House was a then Bullets season ticket holder. And we loved watching Chris Weber play. We're disappointed by how his career turned out. And it's weird. We're both defending him and still mad about certain things. So you can listen to that in the Book of Basketball feed. Also did a new Rewatchables this week, Country Strong. And Dave Jacoby and I broke down episode 2 of The Challenge on the Ringer Dish podcast. We're doing that every Wednesday night. 25 minutes an episode is the max. It's the ceiling. And we just wanted to hang out together once a week. That's really it. There's no rational reason that Dave Jacoby and I, two guys with real full-time jobs, decided to do a Challenge recap pod every week. I have no explanation for you, but it's happening. I'm just telling you that. Coming up, I'm going to talk to Barack Obama, who was once the president of the United States of America, and Bakari Sellers, who hosts the Bakari Sellers podcast. We taped this last week of November, just for context. I don't think anything is dated from it, but just wanted to give you that context because I remember at some point in here, we're talking about the Ravens Steelers game and some of the COVID stuff. But this was really fun. I think Obama should come on twice a year. I enjoy talking sports and other stuff with him. One note, I actually forgot to record from my end for the first like 7 minutes of this podcast. There's two reasons for that. One, I'm an idiot. And two, I'm an idiot. Obama popped on the Zoom. I thought I was recording and, you know, there it goes. So anyway, my audio isn't perfect for the first, 6 minutes of this pod, but then it's fine after that. So I apologize. Don't ever forget, I'm an idiot. And now, our friends from Pearl Jam. All right, I'm here with former President Barack Obama, Bakari Sellers. We have him for an hour. We're going to get right into it. We're going to talk sports. We're going to do a little speed round, then we're going to talk about your book. Sports first. You got involved with saving the NBA season, which you've talked about, how they called you, LeBron and Chris and those guys. The thing that fascinated me, you've turned into a big brother slash conciliary for all the superstar athletes. When did this happen? Were you in office when this happened, or was it after?
You know, actually, while I was president, I got to know a bunch of these guys. You know, they'd come by the White House. A lot of them knew I was fans of their work. They supported a lot of our outreach efforts. You know, Michelle's Let's Move initiative, or if we were trying to, get people signed up for the Affordable Care Act, and so became friends with a bunch of them. And when stuff came up, they'd sometimes call and or reach out. And, you know, the fact that you see this generation of athletes actually paying attention and being interested in social issues was something that we encouraged because they've got a whole bunch of influence.
You have two daughters. I have two daughters. Bill is raising a young lady as well. And one of the things in the activism that we saw in the WNBA is something that was so heartening. The women in the WNBA, from Maya Moore to Asia Wilson, et cetera, kind of led that charge. Are you excited to see the growth and the kind of emergence of this league and how it's finally flourishing and they are the leaders on the forefront of the social justice movement?
Well, listen, I think let's stipulate that women generally are superior to men.
I second that.
Women athletes are no different. It was interesting. There was such a contrast when you had the men's teams, championship teams come, and then the women's teams come. And, you know, the guys were all nice, but a lot of them would just kind of mumble. And, you know, the same way that all of us probably did if we were 21 or 22 and showed up at the White House. And the women, you know, they would be articulate and engaged and, you know, ask these policy questions. You know, so I wasn't surprised. But, you know, you look at somebody like Maya Moore, who I've known for quite some time, because, you know, my first year she came as a Connecticut champion. And, you know, her investment to the degree where she actually left basketball because she cared so deeply about it was impressive and not surprising. And it's a hallmark of an example of where a law really did make a difference. Mm-hmm. I mean, Title IX really changed the landscape for sports. And those of us who have daughters and see how valuable it is to have women have the same opportunities to compete and excel on the field or on the court, and the confidence it gives them, and their ability then to translate that success later in life. It was a really big deal that at the time, you know, because I'm old enough, you aren't, Bakari, but I'm old enough to kind of remember where just Billie Jean King versus Bobby Riggs was a huge event. The idea that an obviously superior female athlete would beat an old guy was somehow shocking to people. To see that change that's happened, is all for the better.
You know, we, as you mentioned, Bakari is way younger than us, but yes. I am.
Yes.
We grew up
Sorry, Bill, to interrupt, but I do have to publicly give props. Bakari was one of my earliest supporters in my unlikely race to run for the presidency.
He was a young
state legislator. And clearly had nothing to lose, and as a consequence, endorsed my race very early on when people still couldn't pronounce my name.
I was still looking for my name in the book. I read the whole thing twice. And
yeah.
Maybe
in volume two. I was looking in the index, but that's okay.
You're going to get a whole chapter. But we were growing up in Muhammad Ali, John Carlos, Tommy Smith, the big summit with Kareem and Ali, Jim Brown, all those guys. And then you had, even when you had Russell in the White House and you gave him the Medal of Honor, and, you know, Russell was a guy in the 60s who would give speeches about, you know, he'd go to college campuses and talk about, I want everybody out here to think that someday, you know, there's no ceiling for them, that someday they could be the president of the United States. Then he comes to the White House and visits you. It felt like this year revived some of that stuff, and reading some of the quotes that you had about it, you just seem completely energized and jazzed that this torch had been passed, right?
Yeah, you're right. I do think it's generational. You and I, I'm older than you, but you know, we caught the tail end of the 60s.
Yeah.
And there was still that memory and that legacy. Muhammad Ali was still active. I have vivid memories of him speaking and, even a figure like Arthur Ashe, who obviously had a very different style, but, you know, who was very early on talking about South Africa and anti-apartheid and AIDS. And to see this generation pick that back up, I think has been all for the good. Part of it is obviously that the culture itself has changed, right? You know, sports culture is always a little bit youth culture. And young people got activated. And they, these guys are all part of that generation. And I think, you know, obviously you saw it, a high watermark of that kind of activism this summer after the George Floyd murder. But fairly consistently, they have the same kind of attitude that I actually see with my daughters. And I write a little bit about this in the book. They believe in the stuff that their parents and their teachers taught them, even if sometimes the parents and the teachers didn't completely believe it themselves. I mean, they genuinely believe in equality. They genuinely don't understand how somebody could be, you know, discriminated against because of race or because of sexual orientation or what have you. And they're almost surprised and disappointed in a way that, you know, is not naive, but is instead, I think, reflective of their values and their willingness to fight for their values. And I think that's a positive thing. The challenge, I think, for them, and this was true, you know, for Ali and Russell and Brown, is always how do you translate that activism then into concrete measures? And that's a lot of times when I'm talking to these guys, you know, what really the conversation is about is, okay, we know we want to do something. We're willing to put ourselves out there. But how do we translate our impulse towards social justice into something concrete that will actually do some good and make a difference? And a lot of them, because they've become more sophisticated on the business side, they now are eager to get a strategy, you know, to and figure out, all right, how can I leverage my platform, but also how can I, you know, leverage my relationship with my owner, or how can I, you know, deal with, you know, my shoe sponsors or what have you. And that, I think, is the next evolution, is them translating this not just from protest, but then also understanding how they can use their power, which is significant, formidable, more than it was probably 20 or 30 years ago.
I think one of the major differences we see is now, instead of it just being the star athlete on a particular team, it's 1 through 15 all using their platform. It's not just, you know, LeBron James, but it's also, you know, Jared Dudley or whoever doesn't take off their warm-up. But my question is, you know, these players, they utilize their capital. In Milwaukee, you had the arena open. In Atlanta, State Farm Arena was open. So what do these players do next? And How does a vice president-elect Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, how do they leverage these individuals to utilize their platform to do what's next, which is kind of create that tangible change?
Well, look, you know, there are going to be specific instances. Let's say you've got a Georgia senatorial race coming up, and obviously voting is still relevant. In each of their markets, you know, one of the things that I have suggested is that something like the criminal justice system is actually pretty local, right? Decisions really aren't made at the presidential level. They're made, the mayor appoints the police chief, or there's a police board, or, you know, there are contract negotiations about, you know, how police are, you know, held accountable if something goes wrong. And the district attorneys and the state's attorneys are making all those decisions. So for a lot of them, I think getting involved locally on the issues they care most about can actually have a huge impact and make a big difference. And obviously, you don't have to be a LeBron to have influence if you are a star or even just a player in that city. The other thing, though, that I've talked to them about is creating a structure that can sustain itself. I mean, I joke, I don't necessarily, I didn't save the NBA season, but these guys had a question about whether they should go back to play after Milwaukee, after the Milwaukee Bucks decided not to play, and all the NBA players in the bubble were trying to figure out what to do. One thing I said to him is, look, the reason you guys are calling me at midnight is because you don't have an organization that is staffed that can strategize, keep up with stuff, you know, pay attention to the details. Because all these guys are still young men who have a profession and a craft that they've got to focus on. It's too much to expect of them. For them to be experts in every one of these areas. But they, if they pooled the resources and they had a couple of staff attorneys, they had, you know, communications and an organizational network that was giving them all information about how they could have an impact on any given issue that they care about, that, I think, could be really powerful.
You know, you're writing your book about lessons you learned from previous generations, right? And older politicians, stuff like that. I'm so fascinated by this generation of athletes and it really starting with the LeBron era, learning from the mistakes of the people before them, right? You think about the guys, the Jordan era, everybody's kind of out for themselves and everyone's making a lot of money, but they don't care about public perception, any of that stuff. They're just, they care about succeeding and that's it. And that gradually evolves during the LeBron era. And now you see these young guys coming in and they're like finished, polished products at age 21, 22, 23. I don't fully understand it, but they've also, the guys they're emulating now are LeBron off the court as well as on. And I'm sure you've talked to some of those guys. Are you?
Yeah.
Are you like blown away when you have conversations with these dudes? They're 25 and they have this wherewithal of everything already?
I mean, I think that they and their parents have learned from some of the mistakes of the past, both in terms of how to handle their finances.
Yep.
You know, it is unlikely that you're going to see a repeat of somebody getting a $100 million contract and ending up broke, right?
Yes.
Because
the Vin Baker story. These,
right. Yeah.
And these guys have you know a clear sense of how to negotiate with agents, how they think about their contracts, how do they think about their endorsements. You know what's interesting, listening to them. By the way, it's not just that they're learning from the mistakes of some of their predecessors; they're also a hip hop generation, and they've learned from the examples of guys like Jay-Z, and you know Diddy and others who became entrepreneurs and you know owners of their content, and sort of liberated themselves from the old studio models and you know the record deals where you know some great Motown artist or others end up not having as much as you would think given their popularity, and so that sort of cross pollination between hip hop and athletes, particularly in the NBA, I think has been interesting because they all see themselves as not just employees of a of a team, but they right. see themselves as an enterprise. Now, you know, there are some downsides to this. You know, Bill, you've talked about this on your show. It diminishes to some degree team loyalty, right? So the kind of experience as a fan that you have of loving a team, even if it's a loser. Yeah, you think about the Chicago Cubs, right? And somebody like an Ernie Banks, right? Who is beloved, even though the Cubs never won, right? But he was their guy. And you know, you lose some of that. I think that there's some downsides to how players are getting developed now because they think of themselves as an enterprise. The whole interaction with AAU and you know how they think about their own development, I think in some cases leads to guys entering the league very sophisticated on the business side, but maybe don't have the same skill sets and you know coaching that, let's say, Michael Jordan got at North Carolina or a Tim Duncan got from Wake Forest. And it means that, you know, if it's a LeBron or, you know, some of these other guys, it doesn't matter. But for folks who may not be transcendent talents, you know, it may mean that their careers on the basketball court or in other arenas may not be quite as polished when they come into the league.
What do you, I mean, one of the things that we've seen in sports is a lack of diversity in the ownership ranks and throughout coaching. I mean, me and Bill were talking prior too. I mean, we'll chip in. I think I have about 1,000. Bill's going to do it a little bit more. If you want to buy the Bulls, we can be a part of your team.
Yeah, what are you doing? How have you not bought a team yet? It's been 4 years. What are you
doing? I still got to pay student loans. So
let me tell you something. The thing I wouldn't do is, you know, like Jay-Z was quote unquote part owner of the Nets. Right,
it's 1%. It basically means you get 0.1. Like, yeah,
courtside seats and I don't
free
know
popcorn.
What
you
else.
Get popcorn.
Yeah. Free popcorn. You know, to me, owning a team would only make sense if you actually have a controlling stake and you are then building a culture and creating the kind of organization that. You know, like the Patriots or the Spurs, where you have sustained excellence. And, you know, I don't have that kind of money. No matter how many books I sell, you know.
I thought when you did the Spotify deal and the book deal, I was like, oh, he's making his move. He's putting it together.
That's it. That's what he wanted to do.
The Bulls. He's talking to Reinsdorf.
No, you know, Jerry, I know Jerry, and I don't think Jerry's going to be selling anytime soon.
No, none of those guys want to get out of there. This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Sales Navigator. Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever. That's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. It's a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator also helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals like job changes or which accounts you should prioritize, and shows you hidden allies so you can find those buyers that are more likely to convert, and even in some cases, most likely to convert. Sales Navigator gives you up-to-date data fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/Bill Simmons. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Start your 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/Bill Simmons. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
The thing that's impacted us the most, especially as an SEC football fan, I'm a big Gamecock fan. I miss being able to go to the stadium, is this COVID-19 and its effect on sports. How do you think? I mean, you've run a country, you're a leader of the free world. How do you think these sports franchises and leagues, from the wobble to the bubble to the NFL not really caring what happens, they're going to play football regardless. How do you think these leagues are handling this this COVID outbreak?
Yeah, and on top of that, the strategy is the NFL is just like, we're plowing ahead. We're just playing the games. Yeah. The NBA is putting more thought into it. What would you do?
I would say that, number one, it's hard for any of these sports leagues to do a good job if the White House is not doing a good job. If at the top, folks are shambolic and dismissive and full of misinformation and politicizing stuff, then, you know, it leaves everybody else on their own to have to make these ad hoc decisions. And so. With that caveat, I would say the NBA and Adam Silver handled it as well as it could have been handled. And you know, just generally, the partnership between the players, the owners, the commissioner, at least the dialogue, you know, I don't want to over-romanticize it, but you do get a sense that everybody there figured out, look, we're all in this together. If we're going to do it right, this is what we have to do. It's going to require everybody to sacrifice. And, you know, the fact that they came through that process and the playoffs ended up being really exciting, really well played. You know, kudos to them. That was impressive. Baseball, I thought, did a reasonably good job. Look, the NFL right now, as we speak, I guess there's a game coming up.
Yeah.
You know, with the Baltimore Ravens having like half their players not playing. You know, it does feel maybe because it's a 53-man roster that everybody feels more expendable, and the notion is, look, you know, we just put something up there. I don't feel that they have been as cautious in terms of their design.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest with you. Probably the area where I'm most frustrated is college, right? Because whatever happens at the professional level, at least these are adults who are getting paid, and they're making a series of decisions that may be suboptimal for the players, but for the most part, you're not putting other people at risk. When I watch college football in particular right now, we'll see how basketball develops. There is this sense of the economics driving a series of decisions in which a bunch of very young people are being put at risk in ways that are unnecessary. But that gets me into a whole set of questions about the NCAA that could take up too much time on this program.
Should athletes get paid? NCAA athletes get paid?
Yes. I think that the amount of money that is being made at the college level, the risks that, let's say, college football's players are being subjected to, and the fact that for many of these colleges, what these young people are doing are subsidizing athletic director salaries and
coach salaries.
All of that argues for a better economic arrangement for them. I think there is a way of doing that that doesn't completely eliminate the traditions and the love we all have for college sports.
Yeah.
It just means that, if Zion Williamson or, Trevor Lawrence or somebody is participating in those sports, and somebody, the local car dealer or what have you, who as it is already probably a booster and doing a whole bunch for that university, wants to also help that student, with their parents or, facilitate them, being able to get a better training situation for their next stage, that penalizing those kids when everybody else is benefiting does not make sense to me. And when you look at the history of the NCAA and how it developed, it developed specifically to insulate these institutions from claims made by these students. The whole myth of student athletes really evolved in part because early on, football players, who were being brought in, as ringers on these teams, were getting hurt and then suing for workers' comp. And suddenly the colleges figured out, if we form this association and create this whole ideal of student athletes that, will protect our pocketbooks. So yes, we should make some changes there.
First time I met you, 2012, I gave you the solution. You didn't listen to me. You were president for 4 more years. I told you, you had to create a sports star position. You could have fixed this.
You did suggest that. Now
you didn't listen to me. You just ignored it. You swatted me away like Mutombo.
I do take some credit for the college playoff, which as president I promoted.
That's fair.
And has worked out pretty well. So come on,
there
man.
There you go.
As is a major theme in the book, I didn't get everything done, but I got a lot done.
I do think the sports bar thing in 2020 was proved more than ever that we might have needed one, right? It was just complete lawlessness depending on the sport.
And a lot of countries have it. And you know, I have some things to some ideas that if I were sports czar, I'd probably, you know, promote.
In your spare time, you could do it. It's like an hour a day. Yeah. Over breakfast.
NFL overtime rule.
Yeah.
Change that. I don't understand how one team, if it scores a touchdown, the other team doesn't get the ball back. Doesn't make sense to me.
Fair.
Maybe move the 3-point line back a little bit.
Why? So only Dame Lillard and Steph can shoot?
Yeah. It should be a little tougher. You know, when I start seeing 7-footers launching threes, that tells me it's gotten too easy.
That's a solid point. When Brooke Lopez is making them, it's gone too far.
Let me ask one of these generational questions for you older guys. Is Steph the greatest shooter of all time?
I think he is.
That's not even a question. Yeah. Absolutely.
I think he has the best hand-eye coordination of just about anyone I've ever seen.
I have not seen anybody who can shoot that way in as many ways, in as unlikely ways, as consistently as Steph Curry. And you know, I know Steph well. Everything he does, is just, it's precise and neat and tight. One of the things I described, and you really saw this as president, because all these athletes would come in, Olympic folks would come in, and, you know, these world-class athletes, they're like X-Men, like some of them you can tell are like the Hulk, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're standing next to LeBron, you know he's a freak.
Yeah.
You stand next to Steph, and you know, he's like one of those guys who he has some superpower with, you know, he takes off his glasses and saying, you can't see right away, but is just as much of a freak. It's just is not as obvious. Or you take even somebody like a Rondo. I remember the first time I shook hands with him, and he's shorter than me, but his arms like reach down to his ankles, and his hands are, you know, just buried mine. And you realize, no, there's a reason this guy's a professional. Just because he looks normal, he is not.
But Carr, you know what? That he really just told us that he's down with Steph Curry in golf. Steph Curry is higher than him in the head-to-head career earnings.
With all due respect to my president, Steph beats my president Barack Obama in golf every day of the week.
Steph is a really good golfer. I mean, Steph Curry, Ray Allen. You know what's interesting? The two best NBA golfers may also be the two best shooters of all time.
Yeah, because it's hand-eye.
Hand-eye, muscle memory, you know, just being able to repeat a motion.
But what does that say
again
about Charles Barkley? Got to be number three. So what does that say about his?
Charles Barkley is definitely not number three.
What's this? Gives us a good entry into speed round. We're going to do this fast because we want to talk about
your
book. First one, we'll go, Bakari and I will alternate here. So golf, they have these televised celebrity skins golf matches. Yeah. A, would you ever do it? And B, who's your partner?
I would never do it because, look, the first time I chili dipped a shot or took three to get out of the bunker, and now suddenly that's a gif, right? It's just playing over and over again on the internet.
So not worth it. Who's your partner if you did do it? Alternate universe, you're doing it.
I guess Tiger. Why wouldn't I?
good answer.
The best golfer of all time.
your Mount Rushmore sports four across all sports.
Ali. Jordan. Willie Mays. Mm-hmm. Maybe Serena?
I bet you weren't going to say Serena.
But Kari said you weren't going to say Serena.
I tell you, you look at her dominance.
It's
over
the second to none. She might be the greatest athlete
longevity,
of all time.
I mean, she, in terms of our lifetime, you know, you've got Brady, you've got Jordan, you've got
LeBron,
Phelps, Federer, Bolt, and Serena, right? I mean, you've got maybe those are the ones who, you know, maybe Mike Trout, you know, when his career's over, you might say the same thing, but those folks were, and Tiger, they were that much better than everybody else. In their primes, they exceeded everyone else in a way that nobody else did. Maybe LeBron, by the time he's done as well.
Next 12 years, you're trying to win NBA titles. Giannis, Luka, or Zion?
I want to see if Giannis gets a mid-range this year.
Okay.
You know, everybody's worrying about Giannis getting a three-point shot. Giannis needs a 12-footer or a 15-footer. That's what matters, right? If he does, then I think he's unstoppable. If he has the same shot as a Karl Malone or even a Kawhi, right, where in crunch time he can just pull up, who's going to block that shot? So if he doesn't develop it, then probably Luka, just because more skill set. Although Zion's just more fun to watch because
he's a monster.
I got Luka.
Yeah, I know you do, Bill.
That's my guy.
You're fantasizing once. This is like the whole Larry Bird, you know, fantasy back up in your head.
He's the best 21-year-old player ever.
He is Luka. Remarkable.
He's pretty remarkable. You better get on the bandwagon.
I don't like the disrespect to Zion Williamson, my South Carolina boy right now. I'm taking Zion every day of the week. So 90s Bulls or last decade Warriors?
Mm.
The Bulls will always be my team because, you know, that hometown. But those two teams are the two teams in the NBA, I guess, along with Showtime Lakers. There are certain teams that transcend the sport, and you have so much fun watching them. It doesn't mean that you don't respect the other champions, but those were teams that entertained as well as they played. And in that sense, they're comparable, right? 2016 Warriors was as much fun as basketball gets.
Yeah,
the regular, that 25-game streak they had was fantastic. Yeah. Your most fun moment as a dad during the quarantine, because underrated quarantine, Bakari's kids aren't old enough yet. Underrated quarantine, when you have teenage girls or older, they're stuck with you. They can't go anywhere. You get all this extra quality time you didn't expect. So what was your best moment?
It's a blessing because all the teenage stuff is kind of gone now. And they're just back and they love you again. And they want to spend time with you. And, you know, they're funny. So, like I think a lot of families, we went through that first month where we were playing games every night and doing a little arts and crafts projects. And then slowly, you know, they started getting a little bored with us. Maybe teaching Malia and Sasha and Malia's boyfriend, who was with us for a while, spades, and then having some spades games.
That's contentious.
Yeah, you know, and teaching them how to properly trash talk and slap the cards down. And
you might be getting out of Bill's wheelhouse right now.
How dare you? like I haven't played spades. I'm more stunned that Malia's boyfriend was quarantining with you. That is the biggest revelation of the podcast.
He's British, wonderful young man. And he was sort of stuck because there was a whole visa thing and he had a job set up. So we took him in and I didn't want to like him.
Yeah.
But he's a good kid. Right. The only thing you discover, this is not a surprise to you, Bill, because you've got a son. Young men eat
constantly.
It's weird to watch them consume food. And my grocery bill went up about 30%.
Picard, this sounds like an NBC sitcom pitch.
It does.
British
I
guy
know.
Moves into former president's house during quarantine with his daughter.
Only if,
I think
only
somebody
if we can produce
is going to buy this.
Do you know anybody at Netflix? I mean, there we go.
I'll make some calls.
You want to go into the book or you want to do a couple more?
No, do one more question. One more each.
Okay. I got two questions, though, so I'm going to just run them off. Ollie Tyson in their prime.
Ollie.
Who wins? Seriously?
Ollie.
I got Ollie, yes. too.
Yeah, Tyson. I'd be more scared of Tyson in a barroom brawl, but Ali, the man went to prison, or at least was stripped of his title and was at risk of going to jail in his prime, comes back
and still
he beat Foreman, who was more imposing than Tyson in his prime.
Yeah.
George Foreman was so slow. He was so slow. Mike Tyson was fast and strong. George Foreman, you can see him coming.
Go back. Just go back and watch the tapes.
Yeah.
You know,
go watch the Frazier fight.
I am not one of those guys who is always, the older guys, it used to be better. In basketball, for example, I'm not a believer that, sometimes I get in arguments with Jordan about there's no hand checking now and this and that. These guys are soft. I actually think basketball is better now that they're better athletes. They're more skilled.
Me too.
And I think that's true about just about every sport. It's interesting with football that when I was president, the 72 Dolphins came by because they never got their White House visit because...
Nixon.
Yeah, there was a few problems going
Some
on.
Stuff happening
with Mr. Nixon. So we had them in, and those guys, compared to the guys now, are tiny. Nick Bonacani, who's like their middle linebacker, is like the size of a cornerback now.
Yeah.
There's just no comparison. But having said that.
I got you.
There are times where you look at somebody like Muhammad Ali, that guy.
Timeless.
He was timeless.
My last speed round question. Would you ever play Trump in golf in a loser absolutely has to leave the country pay-per-view match? So that's it. One of you has to go.
Who's keeping score? Who's counting strokes?
Third parties.
Yeah,
third parties matter.
I think that'd be my caveat. I'd want somebody following to make sure that we were tracking every stroke.
Good answer. All right, let's talk to the book. First of all, your main goal, I know, was to write a book that was longer than mine.
And I succeeded.
You did it. You did it by like 50 pages.
But it's only part one.
Right. Yeah, part two's coming. This is a super nerdy writer question. So I was struck by how many details you remembered from basically the 10 years, the 2-year campaign, and then I guess 6 years, because you haven't done the 4 yet, but I'm sure it's going to be the same thing. All the details you remembered. And then also the way you were able to color in descriptions of the people who passed through your life, right? The people in your cabinet, the people who helped with the campaign, even like world leaders and stuff like that. And it reminded me almost of if a reporter had been embedded with you during this stretch, this is kind of how they would have written it. But you were the reporter, and I can't figure out how you did it when you're writing everything longhand, which is the craziest thing I've ever read in my life. Bakar, he didn't type in a computer. He was writing it out on paper.
I know. When I read that in the intro, because authors here, I just had a book come out too. I was like, this is kind of crazy.
Yeah, what's happening? So how did you remember all this stuff? Are you like one of those memory freaks who remembers every single thing?
It's interesting. I remember scenes, even as they happen, they come to me as scenes, right? So there are times where we'd be in the Oval Office and somebody would say something, and it would be funny or scary in the case of, for example, you know, our first meeting about the economy as I'm coming in, where I think that was a good line, you know, and you know, that will work, that would work as a scene. It's almost how I understand and process what's happening to me at that time, and it sticks with me. So, you know, I didn't keep daily journals. I guess Reagan and Carter would write everything down at the end of the day. I found that I was just spent by the end of the day, you know, just had too much work. But I'd jot down if there was a memorable scene, I'd sort of just scribble something down and kind of put it in a drawer. So that it would trigger a memory. But look, the other thing, it is true that I write out longhand initially the first draft, and then I type it in the computer, and that's kind of my first edit. On the other hand, I use the heck out of a computer in terms of research. And there's no way that I would have been able to write this book without 10 researchers if I'd been writing it 20, 30 years ago. Now you've got an iPad and, you know, I could literally pull up every press conference I had had, you know, contemporaneous accounts of every single event that it had, you know, you just type in the date.
And suddenly, it's triggering memories too, right? It's bringing
stuff back. As you're reading it, you're, oh man, I you know, and so sorting out, for example, my memory about sequence was not always spot on. You know, sometimes I think something happened a little bit earlier, happened a little bit later. One of the, probably the most striking things for me about writing the book was realizing how much went down just in the first 3 months of my presidency, right? Things that in my mind I knew happened the first year, but then it turns out, oh no, actually, you know, I passed the Recovery Act to save the economy in the first month, and the auto bailout was a month later, and you know,
Lilly Ledbetter was right up there too.
Right, or alternatively, I had not remembered the fact that when we, when I order the raid against Bin Laden, I had remembered that it was at the same time as Trump and birtherism.
Yeah.
But I had forgotten that it was only a month after we had launched missiles into Libya to try to prevent Muammar Gaddafi from carrying out a genocide there. It was only a month before we had a debt ceiling crisis that almost spun the economy out of control again. So that's where computers came in handy. It's just, you know, kind of getting the calendar of when all this stuff happened. But once I'm in the scene, I was able to recall it pretty well.
One of the, except recalling Bakari Sellers in the book, but that's okay. I digress. That was a miss. But you know, it's four and three-four stars because of that omission. You know, one of the things, like one of your best pieces of oratory came in trying to convince Michelle and everyone else to, when you were, you know, going off before you went to Thanksgiving, I believe, to Hawaii to talk about running for president, and you have this quote. And you were talking about the reason why you, why me? And you say, I know that kids all around this country, black kids, Hispanic kids, kids who don't fit in, they'll see themselves differently too. Their horizons lifted, their possibilities expanded. One of the characters in this book that I love, that is one of my favorite characters of your White House, is Pete Souza. He was somebody who, the photographer, I don't even know what this man looks like, Bill. If he walked in here, I would have no idea what he looks like. But he captured all of these images, and I always tell people that probably the best image is the image of the Bin Laden raid. But the second best image is the picture of you and Jacob Philadelphia together. Do you recall that image where the young man asked you, "What does my hair feel like?" And we laughed and joked about the successes that you may or may not have had. But one of the successes is that you realized that promise Talk about that moment where that kid was able to reach up and touch your hair, and talk about how you encompassed meaning so much to Black and brown kids around the world, showing them that they could be leader of the free world too.
Yeah, that is one of my favorite photographs, and it's one of Pete Souza, who was the White House photographer, not just for me, but for part of Ronald Reagan's term, and it just became a close friend. One of his favorite images, one of the things you do as president, mixed in with going to the Situation Room or meeting with your cabinet, is you just have to take a lot of pictures, right? People are coming through, visiting. There's staff turnover, and so this African-American couple, the gentleman had worked for one of the agencies. They come in with their two kids. One of them's eight. I think the other one's five. And the little boy, he's got his little tie on and his little shirt, and you can tell, his mom and dad are just barely, keeping him neat for this photo. And he just raises his hand. He says, "I got a question. Does your hair, is your hair the same as mine? Does your hair feel like mine?" And I say, "Well, why don't you check it out?" And I lean down and he touches the top of my head, and Pete captured the picture. And it became probably one of the favorite pictures. Pete would take these pictures and hang them up in the White House in the hallways. And then he'd rotate them out usually, but that one stayed there for 4 years just because everybody loved that photo. I tried never to overstate the power of the symbolism of our presence in the White House. I write in the book when I'm visiting a favela in Brazil, that what they need more than just a symbolic wave from a guy who looks like them is they need better schools and, better healthcare and decent housing. So it doesn't replace concrete changes in people's lives, but there's no doubt that our presence there, for a generation, it became normal and routine. It did not seem unattainable. Mm. How that ends up affecting a generation of Black kids, brown kids, but also white kids. Because what was interesting was, I can't tell you how many parents would come up to me and say, our kids think that, it is a given that there'd be somebody who is darker than them who is also the president. And how that ends up changing attitudes for that generation coming up, you don't know. But I'd like to think that it opened up some minds and hearts particularly for younger people.
So the tail end of your book is the Bin Laden raid and a little bit of the Trump birtherism stuff. And you also kind of go backwards, going to the Tea Party and kind of the seeds of everything that happened the last 4 years. I thought it was interesting, and maybe you're going to do this in the next volume. You didn't really attribute a lot of where we are now to the internet and the ability of the internet to polarize things, to have misinformation, stuff like that. I don't even remember the last time you and I talked. I don't even think we talked about that piece of it. Do you look back now and think like, man, maybe we should have regulated some of this internet stuff differently? What could I have done? Should I have put more power into trying to fix this before it became an issue? Like, how do you think of it now?
Yeah, I hint at it because we were early adapters of social media in the 2008 campaign.
For a positive. In a positive way.
Yeah, yeah, it was great for us, right? It was MySpace and Meetup. And it's part of the reason we were able to mobilize all these young volunteers who actually knew how to work this stuff. I didn't, but we had a bunch of 25-year-olds who were all like, "No, really, Mr. President, this, there's a group in Idaho, Idahoans for Obama, and they're going to get organized through Meetup." And I was all like, "Okay, fine." And the next thing you know, you've got you know, 16,000 people in a basketball stadium in, you know, Red, Idaho, and we end up winning that state because of the power of that social connection. So my view was shaped by that, and I thought, this is democracy. This is going to empower citizens. People's voices are going to be heard. People are going to be able to learn about each other and understand each other. And even as late as the Arab Spring, which is now, you know, so we're fast forward, forwarding to 2010, mm-hmm. 2011, 2012, you know, you're still thinking that all those kids in Tahrir Square who are expressing, you know, their desire for freedom and expressing themselves and organizing these impromptu rallies that, you know, help result in overthrowing a longtime authoritarian leader, Mubarak. And you're thinking, all right, this is still a positive, force. And it wasn't, I think, until, in, as you note, volume two, where you start realizing, well, actually, ISIS can also mobilize through social media. And, you know, neo-Nazis also are finding themselves and each other through the internet. I think that it is a... It's a fair characterization that the optimism I had about it in the first couple of years, was shared by a lot of the folks on my staff because of where we had come from. And it wasn't until later that we started saying, okay, there's a downside here. Now, what that means, you are absolutely right, Bill, and I've talked about this in some interviews. If you ask me, what is the thing I worry about most about our democracy? Trump did not create the kind of deep polarization that we're seeing right now where folks just occupy two entirely different realities.
Yeah.
He was an accelerant to it, but he didn't create it. And social media is helping to drive that. The question now, I think, becomes, is there a combination of regulation, but also the companies themselves adopting just smarter practices in order to curb some of that? We're not going to get back to the time where you got Walter Cronkite and everybody's just watching, you know, three networks and everybody's completely on the same page. But we can do a better job. And you know, I've had conversations with the leaders of some of these platforms and reminded them, look, you can pretend like you're a utility, like the electric company, but you guys are media companies and you're packaging information and your algorithms are making determinations. And you have some responsibility, not just to increase your market share no matter what's out there, but in fact, you have a responsibility to make sure that we're not tearing ourselves apart in this country. And it is a powerful force. I write about the fact that when I ran for the U.S. Senate, and as late as 2008, when I'm running in Iowa, I could go into rural communities, very conservative, almost entirely white, that, you know, might not be obvious sources of votes for me, but because I could go into the local newspaper and have a conversation with the editorial board, or I could show up at a VFW hall and just talk to people face to face, you know, they'd give me the benefit of the doubt. I could have a conversation. They might not agree with me on everything, but they'd get a sense of who I actually was. If I went to some of those same communities now and all they're seeing is either Fox News or Newsmax or some Facebook page in which, you know, I am some wild-eyed socialist, you know, you can't have a conversation. The filter's too thick.
Yeah.
And it goes both ways, right? Although there's not a complete equivalence. And sometimes folks who are non-political, you know, who mainly cover sports, sometimes there's like, both parties, you know, it's so polarized, et cetera. There is an asymmetry going on right now.
Yes.
Generally speaking, it's not that there aren't some folks who have wacky ideas and are extreme ideas inside the Democratic Party, but the mainstream of the Democratic Party is still rooted in facts and generally abides by, the whole—
Except for Bakari.
But the whole idea of, let's like have two sources for a story and let's listen to scientists like Fauci when he says that COVID's bad. We generally are still abiding by that a little bit more. Climate change, things are getting hotter. You know, we can have a debate about whether, what we should do about it, but, those wildfires in California are coming more frequently for a reason.
Yeah. Go ahead, Bakari.
So in your book a lot, you talk about leading up, you talk about the differences between your presidency or your campaign and some of the campaigns that came before you, like Jesse Jackson, like Shirley Chisholm, et cetera. And what I want to, you talk about race a lot. And talking to Axelrod, he was somebody who would always say, we didn't have to talk about him being the black man in the White House. You could actually see that. Something that you talk about is kind of a theme throughout the book. My question is, we're after George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, reading this book, how should we as a country, not just Democrats, navigate this tinderbox of race in the country? And you have these new emerging young black and brown voters who want tangible action items from their elected representatives, whether or not it's reparations, or which is a whole nother episode, or whether or not it's direct infusion of capital into their communities. What should we do? How, as leader of the free world, or as just a regular citizen like myself and Bill, how do we navigate this tinderbox of race?
Well, I feel more optimistic about our prospects of dealing with some of these issues as a result of what happened this summer. Not only because you saw this wave of activism among young people, not only because the demographic of those who marched was not always what you would expect, right? You'd have Black Lives Matters marches in small, all-white towns in Oregon or Utah. And that was indicative of what I told you earlier, which is young people, they believe what they've been taught about, people being equal and needing to be treated fairly, and are disappointed when they see those ideals breached. So I have huge faith in the previous generation, but also those young people were also helping to change the minds of their parents, right? And so you saw the kind of recognition that there's a genuine problem with racial discrimination in the criminal justice system. In polling, a majority, not just of blacks, but also whites, acknowledge that. And that's a huge change from just 10 years ago. If you would add, when you look at attitudes during Ferguson, let's say, and attitudes now, the broader population is more clear-eyed in recognizing there is a problem. And that, I think, is promising and hopeful. Now, the issue always becomes, what do we do with that?
Yeah, once, that's a question.
And I think the thing that I am constantly urging when I'm in conversations with some of these young activists, and look, I've even back when I was president, I had some of the Black Lives Matter activists come in to the Oval Office and sat down and met with them. And I stay in touch with many of them. And my argument is always, how do you translate your impulses into action? How do you change laws? How do you change institutions? How do you change practices? And to do that, you have to be specific in terms of, for example, let's examine how police are trained, or let's examine how district attorneys are able or not able to charge police if you have a case of excessive force. But you also, in order to then get those laws passed or those institutional practices changed, you have to have allies. And the one thing that I insist on, probably partly because, you know, I have a white mother and white grandparents, and so I, by necessity and by biography, I understand the love and regard that they felt for their black grandson, even if, you know, their attitudes weren't always perfectly politically correct. I know that they folks can be reached. I have to insist on the fact that we have to reach out beyond our own group in order to get anything done. And that's true of all groups in America, and will be increasingly true because we are going to increasingly live in a even more multiracial, even more multicultural, religious society. And so if we can't translate our aspirations in a way that white folks can relate to or Hispanics can relate to, we won't get anything done. And that means, for example, if we want police reform and we know that defund the police as a phrase triggers a certain pushback from folks, we're going to need to get something done, then is there a way for us to describe this as very concretely, you know, let's change how policing is done. Let's reallocate some resources so that there's more money in prevention or mental health. A description that doesn't trigger that same kind of pushback. I guess the bottom line is that I think speaking truth to power about race is necessary, valuable, important. Calling it out when we see something wrong is critical. But at the end of the day, in order to actually right wrongs and bring about change, you've got to invite people in to help. You've got to be willing to say to the broader white population, we believe that you can do the right thing and want to do the right thing, as opposed to suggesting, you know, you can't understand us and this is your problem and, right? And that's just human nature.
Yeah.
And it is the nature of putting together political coalitions, which, you know, is the essence of democracy, right? Is how do you get enough votes to actually make something happen as opposed to just feeling righteous about your own position.
Well, hopefully over the next 4 years, we'll see that happen. This is the book. It's right there. It's a nice cover.
I gotta take my 20% off sticker off.
Hey, yeah, Bakari, I expect you to pay full price, man. Come on.
I got twins. Hey. They're 22 months old. I did the best I could do.
Mr. President, great to see you. We threw you a saw by not talking about your cigarette smoking revelations in the White House. Maybe on the next podcast we'll talk about that. But it was awesome to see you. Great book. Great job.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed it. And just to make sure, since you brought it up, the record is clear. It's been 10 years since I
proud of you. Yeah, it was good. Yeah. I was proud of you.
Chewing the heck out of this Nicorette, though. I got to get myself off that stuff.
All right. Good to see you. Thank you.
See you guys.
See you. My best
to your
family.
Have a great holiday.
Thank you. You too.
All right. It's time for Million Dollar Picks. Always like to follow a former president of the United States with gambling in the NFL. Why not? Let's do it. So I am taping this early today. I'm taping this. It is Thursday morning, my time. So we actually have time to incorporate the Thursday night Raiders-Chargers game, which I'm going to cover in 1 second. Taping the picks early in the morning on Thursday, a full 3 days before the games actually start for the most part. Although we do have a Thursday and two Saturday games this week. But, you know, there's a lot of harrowing stuff here with injuries, COVID, guys getting scratched last minute. Just kind of crossing your fingers here. There's other people out there that do gambling, you know, picks, podcast stuff that wait till Sunday or say, check my Twitter on Sunday. I'll give you my picks. Look, I am up this year and I'm putting the picks out on Thursday. I'm up 199,000. I lost 200K last week, mostly because I didn't put enough on the Bills and I really regret it. But I'm still up 199K for the year. And I think doing that on Thursday, I'm really proud of myself, I got to say. So here was my mindset going into week 15. I think this is the weekend when the good teams are like, we're not fucking around anymore. The teams that have a chance to be a one seed or a two seed or a three seed, you're just not catching them by surprise. And conversely, the teams that are pretty much out of it or are out of it, this is around the time when they rolled over. So I actually went through the scoreboard on ESPN because you can check out the games by the years. So I looked at the 10-win teams in week 15 over the last 6 years. And here's what I found. They were 33-4 just to win the game outright. Over the last 3 years, they were 18-1. Going by year, 2019, a team that had at least 10 wins playing a team that had less than 10 wins was 9-0. 2018, 3-1. The 7-7 Eagles beat the 10-4 Rams that year. 2017, 6-0. 2016, 4-1. You had the 8-6 Titans beating the 10-4 Chiefs that year. 2015, 4-1. The 9-5 Steelers beat the 10-4 Broncos that year. And 2014, 7-1. The 8-6 Bills beat the 10-4 Packers that year. So 33-4 over the last 6 years, 18-1 over the last three. And if you look at the four losses, the teams were 7-7, 8-6, 9-5, and 8-6. So in the last 6 years, a team with a losing record has not beaten a team with 10 wins or more in week 15. That makes me feel pretty safe about some of the tease options, which is where I'm gravitating this week. Here's the first one I'm looking at. It'd be a three-teamer. The Steelers are giving minus 12.5 points to Cincinnati. Cincinnati is really abominable the last 5 weeks. I'm not sure if you know about the numbers, but they have scored 50 points total over the last 5 weeks. And that includes a couple Burrow games. They lost all of those games. They're 31st in DVOA. Pittsburgh's fourth. Pittsburgh needs a win. Pittsburgh's coming off that brutal 3 games in 12 days stretch. They need to eat. They need to sit down at the breakfast table and eat. They're not losing that game. So we can tease them down to 2.5. Wonderful. Second one is Ravens minus 12.5 over the Jags. You know, the Ravens defense has fallen apart over the last couple weeks. I'm not even sure you can start them in a fantasy league, even this week against the Jaguars, because they've had too many injuries and it's just too easy to move the ball on them. The Jaguars don't want to win any more games. They're still keeping their fingers crossed that maybe the Jets can win a game and maybe they have a chance to get Trevor Lawrence. There's also one other awesome quarterback in the draft this year. And if you give me like 20 seconds, I'm going to remember his name. I can't remember his name, but there's two. There's two really good ones. So they don't want to fall out of the top two. I don't think the Jags win again. They also don't have the talent to win again. They got murdered last week. So bringing the Ravens down to 2.5, I feel pretty safe there. And then my third one, the Bills are playing Denver. It's in Denver. There are some red flags here, and I'm going to go through them really quickly. You have Denver looked really good the last 2 weeks. They played the Chiefs tough, and then they did a nice job against Carolina. It's weird because on DVOA, their offense is terrible. They're like a bottom five DVOA offense, 28th. But if you watched them the last 2 weeks, I like some of their skill guys. I like Jerry Jeudy. I really like Tim Patrick. My buddy Gus, who's a lifelong Broncos fan, is like, we finally recreated Rod Smith. I agree. I think Tim Patrick's really good. And then Hamler had broke two big plays last week. And they can run the ball a little bit with Gordon and Lindsay. Defensively, you know, they lost some dudes over the course of the year, but they're not awful. You know, they can get a stop. They can get a pass rush every once in a while. So I'm not saying this is going to be an easy game for Buffalo. They're favored by 5.5. Everybody's feeling awesome about them. People are feeling like they, you know, are a legitimate Super Bowl sleeper. I think they're plus 650 on FanDuel to win the AFC right now. And it's a Saturday game, which means a lot of people will be betting on it, which means a lot of people will be teasing the Bills or throwing them in a parlay. I know all of these things. Here's the thing with the Bills. Right now, they're 7th at DVOA. Denver's 28th. Buffalo's offense, 313 first downs, top three. 49.3% on third down, top three. They're 5 out of 6 on fourth down, so their percentage, top three there. They're 3rd in passing yards. They have emerged as, I think, an incredible offense. I think they're really, really, really good offensively. And honestly, they're probably 95% as good as the Chiefs right now. The Chiefs still have the Mahomes factor. They still have the Tyreek Hill can have the 80-yard touchdown on any play factor. But numbers-wise, they're pretty much as explosive. They can move the ball in whatever way they want to move it. And when you throw out a couple of the weirder games they had earlier in the year where they had that one game, terrible weather against KC, they had another game where the COVID thing kept pushing it around. They had another weird Jets game. But if you just took their best like 6 offensive games this year and ranked them against the other team's best 6, they'd probably be the best offense in the league. And it feels like they're peaking at the right time. We can tease them with a 10-point tease to plus 4.5 in Denver, which I really like because even, let's say the worst case scenario, Denver gets a kick return touchdown like they did last week. Allen throws a pick 6, whatever scenario you want to do. Even if the Bills are down 10 in the final 3 minutes, they're coming down and getting a garbage time touchdown. And Denver's not good enough to blow out Buffalo. I personally think Buffalo is going to run the slate, finish 13-3. And put a ton of pressure on Pittsburgh to close out and not get that third loss. Because if they do, then the Bills will be the 2 seed. So that 3-team tease would be Steelers down to 2.5, Bills up to plus 4.5, and then the Ravens down to 2.5. Mark that down. I have another tease for you. The second bet I'm looking at, I mentioned we use 2 of the 10-win teams in that 3-team tease. We use Pittsburgh and we use Buffalo. Buffalo going against the 5-8 Broncos and the Steelers going against the 2-10-1 Bengals. Over the last 6 years, there is no track record, even once, of a team with that record disparity beating a 10-win team in week 15. So we're going to put those two, I think, in the 3-team. The other team is the 10-3 Packers playing the 4-9 Panthers. I think the Packers are running the slate. Rodgers can smell it. They have Carolina, Tennessee, and Chicago left to get the 1 seed. And that's assuming that even New Orleans could potentially run the slate. New Orleans has KC this week. I think KC is going to beat New Orleans. We're going to cover that in a second. Green Bay's not fucking around anymore. They want the 1 seed. Rodgers is 37. He gets it. You skip round 1. Round 2's in Lambeau. Round 3's in Lambeau. That is the easiest path they could possibly ask for in a conference that's pretty weak, you know, that's really not the opposite of top heavy. So I feel like they're in must-win mode every game. Your fear would be, oh, Carolina. You know, they had a couple years ago, they played Green Bay really tight at home. They had that McCaffrey play. But I think in Green Bay's in the we're not fucking around anymore stage. They're close. They're not going to fall asleep on this game. So I love the thought of teasing them. They're at 7.5 over Carolina. Tease them down to 1.5 with the Colts. The Colts are going against Indy. Colts are 8th in weighted DVOA, which weighs like the last like basically 8-9 weeks of the season. Houston's 25th in weighted DVOA. Houston's decimated. They lost Will Fuller and they lost Roby to the suspensions a couple weeks ago. They lost Justin Reed, who's their best safety last week. They lost starting defensive tackle Brandon Dunn. They're a mess and they're playing out the air. Crennel's not going to be the coach long-term. They also kind of shot their wad, almost beating the Colts 2 weeks ago. If you remember, Watson had that fumble. And I just think the Colts, last week, the biggest things that happened with them, Jonathan Taylor, the rookie running back, really emerged as a workhorse last week. And they also got T.Y. Hilton going. And now, you know, with T.Y. Hilton and Pittman and Taylor being able to run the ball and Hines coming in, like they can move the ball a lot better than they did 2.5 months ago. I don't know what took Hilton so long to get going, but I love the idea of teasing them down to 1. So mark that one down. 2-team tease, Indy down to 1, Green Bay down to 1.5. A couple more games that I'll probably put a little less on. First one is the Raiders tonight against the Chargers. Chargers, Mike Williams is out. Keenan Allen's almost definitely out, and if he plays, he's going to be limited. They got really banged up in Sunday's game. Eckler is like game time decision. Even if he plays, he's going to be relatively compromised. They had their feel good win last week, and then on the flip side, the Raiders, who got crushed offensively, but I'm not sure it's going to matter if none of the important Chargers skill guys are playing this week. It's an all-time must. This is a kitchen sink must-win game. The Raiders, they fired their defensive coordinator last week. They have Josh Jacobs back. And I laid out on the pod a week ago, when he rushes for 75 yards, they're 5-0. They're going to run the ball with him this game. The line is 3.5. I'm lowering it to 2.5, which I have to pay odds on. But I'm going to parlay them with the Steelers and the Rams. Raiders 2.5. Steelers, Rams just to win. Is -108. And I'm doing that. So mark that one down. Next one is Washington +5.5 against Seattle. This is just a classic case of this line should be 3. And I'm getting 2.5 extra points with Washington, which has the last 4 weeks, their defense has been a top 3 or 4 defense. They can really, really pressure with a bunch of different dudes. And they have an identity, you know, and the big thing here is Gibson's got turf toe. Is he going to play? Is he going to be the starting running back? They were able to patch together a running game last week anyway with some of the backups. And then from a quarterback standpoint, seems like Alex Smith's going to play. But they know who they are. The thing with Washington, the game's going to be 16-13, 17-14. 13-12, whatever. They're not going to make mistakes offensively, and they're going to try to win games with defense and special teams to a lesser degree. This is the exact type of recipe the Giants threw at Seattle 2 weeks ago. Seattle couldn't block the Giants. They got a lot of trouble in that game, and they got beat. And I just am not sure Washington isn't better than Seattle, or at least even with them. So getting 5.5 is wonderful. I think it's a 3-point game. I don't know who wins. I think it's going to come down in the last 5 minutes. And I think Washington's defense can really frustrate Seattle, a team that doesn't seem like they can block well for Russell Wilson, doesn't have a good running game anymore. And I don't know. I like the matchup. Plus, it's in Washington. And, you know, there's a scenario where Washington, this would really give them some leeway in the NFC East if they pulled this one off. So mark that one down. Last one, Chiefs Saints. Chiefs are still favored by -3 as we're doing this. I think it goes to 3.5 and maybe even 4 by Sunday. They're talking about Breeze possibly playing. He broke 11 ribs. That seems like a lot. Either way, recovering a little bit gun-shy Breeze or Taysom Hill, who I think got really exposed last week. And in general, I don't love the body language on that Saints team. I talked about that with Sal on Sunday. Something doesn't smell right with that team. It has the makings of a team that loses in round one, gets upset, and then 3 days later, the beat reporter for them, for The Athletic or the New Orleans Times, Pekin, whatever that newspaper is, writes an empty the notebook piece about all the terrible things that happened during the season. Feels like that's simmering. This is for the Chiefs. It's like, look, you're the best team in the league. You fucked around against Miami last week. You almost, you know, you let Miami hang around, and they almost came back and made that game interesting in the fourth quarter. Made some dumb mistakes. Mahomes still hasn't totally clinched the MVP yet, even though we feel like he's going to win it. Rodgers is at least lingering. And this is the kind of game, if you're going to win the Super Bowl and go back-to-back, you win this game. They're better than the Saints. I haven't really seen a defense stop them. It's usually the Chiefs doing dumb stuff, stopping themselves. They're healthy offensively, which I like. And I think the line should be higher. I think they're better than 3 points against the Saints. I don't care where the game is. I like the Chiefs. Especially like if they're playing this in the Superdome, great. Because guess what? The Chiefs have the fastest team in the league. I love the fact that it's in the Superdome. Awesome. Great. The Chiefs are going to be, it's going to be like a racetrack for them. So I'm down with the Chiefs. And then long shot parlay of the week. I don't love this. We're just going to dabble on it. But the Eagles are +225 against Arizona. The case for Arizona would be Kyler Murray finally looked like Kyler Murray again last week. case against the Cards is they were playing the Giants and Danny Dimes, who was awful, and they couldn't get anything offensively. And once they fell from behind, it changed the game. And it was one of those games you knew in the first quarter who was going to win. The Eagles, I'm not a fan of. Frankly, I wouldn't mind if they got eliminated. I think they have to be respected at plus 225 because of what Jalen Hurts gave them last week and the energy they had on both sides of the ball. You know, and you think about, like, I'm not sure there's a difference between the Cardinals and the Eagles beyond maybe 3 points, and I'm getting 6.5 in this. From a long shot parlay standpoint, the Eagles are plus 225. Is it realistic that the Eagles could beat the Cards? Yeah. And the other thing, you know, you have all these elimination pools. My friend Brad Mulcahy was on Cousin Sal, our buddy from Sunday Nights, but he also has the Against All Odds podcast on his Extra Points Network. Brad is in this high stakes eliminator pool, and is kind of running out of teams. And one of the teams they're looking at is Arizona -6.5, which I'm sure is on the board for a lot of the people left these eliminator pools. And there's like this weird hesitation with it because Philly has this tendency, especially as we get toward the end of the year, of kind of not dying. They're like Michael Myers. And who knows with the Hurts thing? They figured out how to unleash Miles Sanders a little bit. The coaching is still atrocious. Like, some of the fourth down calls they do is just bizarre. I think they're like 33% on fourth down this year. But do I think they could beat the Cardinals? Yeah. So we're marking that one down, plus 225. Maybe with the Bears, who are playing against the Vikings. They're 3.5-point underdogs in Minnesota. The Vikings have just one of the craziest special team situations I've ever seen. I don't think there's any difference with these two teams. They're both really mediocre, and either team could win. So Bears plus 160, whatever. Eagles Bears together is plus 713. So that is the long, I don't love it, but that's the long shot parlay I'm looking at for this week. So here's what we're going to do for, two more games I wanted to mention before we get to the picks. I looked long and hard at that Giants-Browns game because Jason Garrett, the offensive coordinator for the Giants, has COVID, and Freddie Kitchens is going to be calling the plays for the Giants. And I was trying to figure out what would be a funnier scenario, the Giants completely shitting the bed and Freddie Kitchens finally giving the Browns one last gift, or Freddie Kitchens zinging the Browns and picking them apart and whatever. But the problem is it's Colt McCoy. I don't think the Giants can move the ball. I don't think it's conceivable for them to score more than like 17 points in a football game with the current roster they have. And I really like this Browns team. So the Browns are -5. I'm going to end up staying away. So that was one. The other one was the Pats, who are getting 1.5 in Miami. And Miami has really passed a tipping point with injuries on their offense. You know, they're down to like their 17th string running back, and they had no receivers that finished that game that you would ever start a million years in your fantasy team. And Belichick has this history of beating teams that are either shorthanded or can only do one thing or are crippled in some way offensively. But I just can't bet on Cam Newton from what I've seen. So I'm going to stay away from that. All right, it's time. Let's do the $1 million picks for week 15. Once again, I am up $199,000 for the season. Couldn't be prouder of myself doing these picks on Thursday. It's like having a torn ACL and trying to run a 40-yard dash anyway. I'm not afraid of picking these games on Thursday. First pick, a three-team tease. We're putting $480,000 to win $400,000, -120 odds on this bet. Steelers -12.5 over Cincy. Bills -5.5 over Denver. Ravens -12.5 over the Jags. Steelers go down to 2.5. So do the Ravens, and the Bills go to plus 4.5 in Denver, $480,000 to win 400 on that. Then we're doing a two-team tease. Indy -7 over Houston, Green Bay -7.5 over Carolina. We are putting $300,000 down on that, $330,000 to win $300,000. And then we're going to do some sprinkling. We're going to put $200,000 on a parlay of Raiders -2.5, moving that line down. Steelers to win, Rams to win. It's -108. So $216,000 to win $200 on that. 216K to win 200 on Washington plus 5.5 over Seattle. I think that ends up being a 3-point game. And then 200K on the Chiefs minus 3 against the Saints. And then for the hell of it, long shot parlay of the week, 33K at plus 713 on Eagles plus 225 and Bears plus 160. Both of them have to win. Those are the $1 million picks for week 15. If you missed the Book of Basketball podcast I did on Chris Webber with Joe House, that is on the Book of Basketball feed. New rewatchables coming up on Monday. We are doing the first Bourne movie. So you have 4 days to watch it. And then the cousin and I will be there on Sunday night. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the weekend. Stay safe.